duration of chapter 24 and the similar message in chapter 26, a very similar although distinct incident. Last Sunday you will remember that in the 23rd chapter, one that was full of encouragement for David and for ourselves, we saw God's provision for his servant in times of perplexity and in need of divine direction. And David was led by the Spirit of God. We saw him up against it in the pressures upon him, and he found encouragement through the provision that God made of Jonathan's friendship. He was strengthened by God's grace. And in the latter part of the chapter, we saw him wonderfully delivered in the nick of time, so to speak, by the good hand of God. He was kept by God's power. And we saw all that in the context of the trials and tribulations through which David was passing at this time, and interpreted these trials and tribulations as being part of the divine plan and purpose in disciplining him and making him the kind of man God wanted him to be. He is spoken of as a man after God's own heart. And we see the continuing saga of that discipline in this chapter. But there is a significant difference in the incident recorded here and those in the previous chapter. For in chapter 23, it was the story of things that happened to David and God's grace to him in what he had to endure. He was, so to speak, the passive recipient of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. But here in chapter 24, it's different. It's the story of something David did. And this reminds us of a spiritual life and testimony that has to be maintained even amid the trials and testings of our experience. There is no let up. This is part of the standard that God sets for his children. It sometimes seems, and I'm sure you have found this as I have in my experience, that God surrounds us with the most unpromising of circumstances. Indeed, circumstances in which temptation is most keen and the opportunity to yield to it is at the maximum. And he says, now, live as a man of God should in that kind of situation. And we often feel that's a bit hard, but that's just how God deals with his children. And that's the relevance of David's behavior here in this chapter towards Saul in the cave, and in chapter 26 on the battlefield. And what we see is the work of grace in David's heart and the effect of the testings and disciplines that he has been passing through. And that belongs, in essence, to the message of chapter 23, and emerges from it. The disciplines that he endured in chapter 23 tended to produce the kind of behavior that David shows here in chapter 24. The gracious, godly, Christ-like spirit of forbearance and generous forgiving love that he showed towards Saul, when he might so easily have succumbed to the temptation to rid himself forever of Saul, his enemy. He refused to be overcome of evil. And I think this is a very important thing for us to remember when we read some of the what are called the imprecatory psalms in the Psalter, when David says some seemingly hard and bitter and ferocious things about his enemies. I think we need to interpret these psalms in a particular way, because David is not giving vent to personal spleen in these utterances in the Psalms. He is rather speaking in terms of God's righteous anger and wrath against those who are his enemies. And I think it's salutary for us to read a situation like this. If David were the kind of person that some of the commentators maintain he is in some of these psalms, then he would have had a very different attitude to Saul in this passage before us. Indeed, his attitude would have corresponded much more to his men's attitude. Behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, I will deliver thine enemy into thy hand, that thou mayest do to him as it seemeth good to thee. Take the opportunity, Saul. Slaughter him and get rid of your enemy once and for all and forever. But significantly, David didn't do any such thing. And that's one of the important lessons in the chapter for us. So that we can add a further statement to the first three statements that we underlined last week. Led by his spirit, strengthened by his grace, kept by his power, and now conformed to his image. Now, we did say last week in connection with the reason for these times of testing that was that God was intent on producing for the throne of Israel a man after his own heart. And here we begin to see something of the lineaments of godly character appearing in David. And somehow this suddenly illumines the severe disciplines that he had to pass through in those days. And it illumines them as with a great light. One is reminded of Peter's words in his first epistle. Though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. Here, in this section of 1 Samuel, we see the heaviness, the manifold testings, the trial of his faith. I once came across a very graphic illustration of this. down in the potteries in the Midlands of England, in the Wedgwood factory, there was a piece of dull-looking clay in the window, and a caption which said, "The colouring comes out in the firing." And that's how it was with David. The colouring came out in the furnace of affliction through which he passed. And I don't think we should underestimate the intensity of the pressures that were on David during these days. Certainly, it's possible to read chapter 23 as a wonderful encouragement, and I'm sure that many, and some have told me, got encouragement from the chapter and the study last week. But that doesn't alter the fact that David passed through some very hard and trying and difficult times, and they also are reflected in the Psalms. Now I want you to look at two of the Psalms and see particularly what is said in them in relation to the title that is subscribed on it. Psalm 57. This is a psalm which has as its setting the time when he fled from Saul in the cave. Now, that might refer to the cave of Adullam. It may refer to this cave, but David was certainly on the run. Well, now, look at the spirit of this psalm. Be merciful unto me, O God. Be merciful unto me, for my soul trusteth in thee. Yea, in the shadow of thy wings I will make my refuge until these calamities be overpast. Verse 4, my soul is among lions, and I lie even among them that are set on fire, even the sons of men whose teeth are spears and arrows, and the tongue a sharp sword. Verse 6, they have prepared a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They have digged a pit before me. And another psalm, Psalm 142, which has a similar superscription upon it, Psalm 142. And once again, it says, a psalm of David, a prayer when he was in the cave. I cried unto the Lord with my voice. With my voice unto the Lord did I make my supplication. I poured out my complaint before him. I showed before him my trouble. When my spirit was overwhelmed within me, then thou knewest my path. In the way wherein I have walked, have they privily laid a snare for me. I looked on my right hand, and behold, but there was no man that would know me. Refuge failed me. No man cared for my soul. Verse 6, attend unto my cry, for I am brought very low. Deliver me from my persecutors, for they are stronger than I. Bring my soul out of prison. Now, that shows something of the intensity and indeed the extremity of David's battles and struggles in those days. And these same psalms indicate how his faith helped him and strengthened and encouraged him. In the shadow of thy wings I will find my refuge till these calamities be overpast. My heart is fixed. And in Psalm 142, thou knewest my path. Thou art my refuge. You see how faith rises and is strengthened in the midst of all these things. Now, in such circumstances, when strain is at its greatest and when spirits are at the lowest, it is very, very easy to give way, especially when temptation and opportunity come together, as suddenly as it did on this occasion in the cave. It was the psychological moment, so to speak. And the significant thing is that David, in the face of that situation, when temptation and opportunity came together, he did not yield. Faith triumphed, and he would not lift his hand against Saul. Now, you and I have only to recall how we so often yield to sudden temptation when adverse strain is upon us, to realize the magnitude of David's triumph here. What is it that we say? Yes, I'm sorry I did it, but I was under terrific pressure. And we thereby excuse the enormity of our yielding to the temptation. But it was different with David. Faced with this prime opportunity, on both occasions, in chapter 24 and in chapter 26, when he could have put Saul to death, when he had him at his mercy, he refused to do so. He would not let his hand touch the Lord's anointed. Now it's something to have a restraint upon our behavior in terms of the anointing of the Lord upon a man, even when that man has forfeited the right to be called the Lord's anointed. Even when Saul at this stage was far, far away from God, he still recognized that he had been the Lord's anointed. I will not put out a hand to touch the Lord's anointed. Well, David triumphed in this way. And we see just how deeply God's disciplines had wrought in his soul. And we may learn from that a very important lesson. Sometimes we cavil with God at the sufferings that we often have to go through. But suffering enlarges our capacity to resist temptation and adds a depth to our experience and to our character. And this just shows how free David's heart was from bitterness and rancor during these trials. If it had been otherwise, this temptation would have been yielded to. There is that verse, you know, in the Old Testament which says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so also is he. Now, we live in a relatively restricted society, where so many conventions and customs serve to restrain us from overt evil behavior. And therefore, this kind of battle often has to take place in the realm of our thoughts. And that's where we have to win the victory. In our thoughts. We are not generally in a position where we can do physical despite to those who harm us. It may be just as well, too, that we are surrounded by conventions and customs. But it still remains a question whether in thought we do this. And we see something of the magnitude of God's dealings with this man. And of course, this is a very true index of character. Truer than we often realize. Peter says in his first epistle, lay aside all malice, all guile, all hypocrisies, all envies, all evil speakings. These are all attitudes of mind and heart that don't reach action. But these are the areas where this kind of battle needs to be fought. It is true that sometimes people raise an eyebrow when David is called a man after God's own heart. And they say, what about the Bathsheba episode? And of course this is true. But you know, there are two kinds of sins. Sins of the flesh and sins of the spirit. And the sins of the flesh are often represented by acts. But the sins of the spirit are much more ordinarily represented by attitudes. It's true that sins of the flesh are very real and dangerous and can be disastrous. But so often they come from frailty and weakness of nature and are mixed with that frailty that is the common lot of man. But the sins of the spirit, hatred, malice, spite, envy, are not isolated acts, but enduring attitudes, and are truly corrosive of the human spirit and utterly deadly. Moral failure, sudden loss of temper, the hasty word. These are things that are often sincerely mourned and grieved over and repented of, and real efforts are made to retrieve the situation. And many who have been the victims of these sins have deep feelings of unworthiness and shame and weep much before God for their failures and their sins. But you know, others live habitually with wrong attitudes of heart. Malice can be present in a heart for years. Bitterness, spite. And these are the things that bring blight upon the soul. These are the terrible things that defile a man. And these are the things that keep a man from being after God's own heart. Compare and contrast David and Saul in this. We know all about David's sins. But look at the sins of the spirit in Saul, the grudge, the envy that festered in his heart over all this time, a period of years, against this man whom he saw to be threatening his throne. That's the measure of the victory that David won on this occasion. Jesus did say, you know, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, pray for them that despitefully use you. Well, an interesting point in this story, and in chapter 26 also, is the way in which David pinpointed the source of Saul's attack upon him. In chapter 24, at verse 9, we have David's remonstrance with Saul. Wherefore hearest thou men's words, saying, behold, David seeketh thy hurt? Behold, this day thine eyes have seen how that the Lord hath delivered thee today into mine hand. Why do you say then, David seeketh my hurt? Why have you listened to these false courtiers in your court who have blackened my character before you and fed this unholy fire in you? Why have you listened to them, Saul? The Lord judge between me and thee, and see and plead my cause. And that's one of the sadnesses, isn't it, of the human situation. The devil will always find tools to do his dirty work. Saul, it is true, didn't need much encouragement, because that envy of David and jealousy was there. But there were people like Doeg, that evil, ugly creature, who misrepresented David to the king and fed his unhallowed passion against him. David saw that. He was able to put his finger exactly on the situation. In chapter 6, verse 19, we see the same. Now therefore, I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord have stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering. But if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord. If they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord. Saul, you are the willing victim of evil men. And that's a very interesting picture, isn't it, from the corridors of power. If we were able to read all that goes on in the secret places of government, whether in this country or across the Atlantic Ocean, we might see just how ugly and how sinister some of the things that are said when character assassination takes place at the drop of a hat. That's how it was here. Now, there's a very interesting consideration here, which I think we need to give some attention to. David's men, and we need not doubt their sincerity, they were devoted to their leader. They said, behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand. Kill him now, David, and all your troubles will be over. Now, we know from the history of this time that, and later, that David fought the wars of the Lord with great thoroughness. But there is a distinction between the wars of the Lord and acts of terrorism and acts of violence. And David refused to use violence as a means of establishing his kingdom. If God wants to deal with Saul, that's his prerogative. But I will not put my hand upon the Lord's anointed. And in so saying and so doing, he recognized that violence simply breeds violence. I remember, and I've quoted this before from the pulpit, being very impressed with speech that Sir Frederick Catherwood, one time a Director General of the National Economic and Development Council in government, made to a large gathering of students. And this is what he said to them. Last summer, I talked to a group of students from 20 countries, ranging from communist to capitalist, on Christianity and the social order. Now, I was interested to find that those who were most revolutionary came from the most affluent and politically stable countries. On thinking over the reasons for this, I came to the conclusion that if you are brought up in a very prosperous and stable society, you assumed, if you thought about it at all, that society could take an awful lot of beating without much ill effect. That if you turned parts of it upside down because you didn't like them, the parts you did like would stay the right way up. On the other hand, if you came from an unstable country, you realized that this was not so. That authoritarianism of the right could be replaced by authoritarianism of the left and vice versa. That civil war might wipe out some old inequalities, but would produce a whole crop of new ones. I regard this as a very profound analysis of the human situation, which has a very great deal to say to us today. Nobody in this land can be unaware of the tremendous sense of unrest. I'm speaking of Scotland. And the sense of injustice from which so many seem to smart. And no one can be unaware either of the considerable body of opinion that seemingly will not scruple to engage in extra parliamentary action to gain their ends. Whether it be home rule or poll tax or whatever. Now, Catherwood was impressed to find that those who were most revolutionary came from the most affluent and politically stable countries. I think that that is still a legitimate description of our land in the late 20th century. Affluent and politically stable. One has only to contrast our land with some of the hotbeds of South American lands, for example, and African lands, and Far Eastern lands. And he was impressed by the assumption that such people make, that society could take an awful lot of beating without much ill effect, and that if you turn parts of it upside down because you didn't like them, the parts you did like would stay the right way up. It's not true. It has never been true in history. What has been true in history? That war and revolution, while they can wipe out old inequalities, tend to produce a whole crop of new ones. And we don't have to confine ourselves to thinking about the Russian Revolution in 1917 to make this point. It is true there. That revolution produced the horrors and bestialities of Stalinism, which killed more Russian people than the Second World War did, great as Russia's casualties were then. I think this is what David is getting at. He recognized that violence simply breeds violence. Trust in God, he says. Trust in God. Now, even as I say this, I know that I'm treading in controversial areas. But I must say that I am in agreement with Catherwood's position here. And I think history has made this very clear, that authoritarianism of the right can be replaced by authoritarianism of the left. And if you violate the law because you don't happen to like it, you can hardly complain if others violate laws that you do like. Protest, refuse to obey the law in one particular, and what right have you to complain that lawless, evil men rape innocent women and children? Law is given by God, and we had better realize this before it's too late. I think this is what we see here. And David refused on very good and practical grounds. One last word. One of our hymns speaks of Christ as great David's greater son. And in this attitude of grace that David shows in these two chapters, he's reflecting the heart of God. And that's why he was a man after God's own heart. He did on this occasion, in a small, minute way, what God has done on the grand scale. For this is God's attitude to a mankind that has wronged him and revolted against him, despite all his care and in despite of his holy laws. One of the hymns that we might well have sung this morning has lines which say, "Though for good we render ill, he accounts us brethren still." Look at the cross. When evil men took God's only son and cruelly murdered him, when they were spitting on his face, insulting him, thrusting the ignominious crown of thorns on his head, when men did their worst to him, even in that humiliation, God in Christ was accomplishing a world's redemption. And the very spear that pierced his side drew forth the blood to save. When we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son. And this is the basis of all God's dealings with us, all of grace from beginning to end. And David reflects in a minute way this sparing of his enemy, because he loved him as the Lord's anointed. Read at the end of the story when Saul and Jonathan were killed in the battle at Mount Gilboa. And that encomium that David uttered about that man who was his enemy. How generously he spoke about him. That reflects the Spirit of Christ. That was what made David a man after God's own heart. I will not touch the Lord's anointed. God forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth mine hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. So David stayed his servants with these words, and suffered them not to rise against Saul. Led by his Spirit, strengthened by his grace, kept by his power, and now conformed to his image. It all belongs together, you see. The trial of your faith, much more precious than of gold that perisheth, shall be found to be to the praise of his glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ. May God himself bless his word to us all for his great name's sake.